Welcome back to The Bonfire, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts with some of the people closest to the fight game. I am your host, longtime MMA journalist and MMA Junkie senior reporter, Mike Bond. It is the final UFC pay-per-view week of 2024, folks, with UFC 310 set to go down Saturday at T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. I am really stoked for this card. It is quite nice overall, in my opinion. And of course, headlined by a flyweight title fight between Alexandre Pantoja and the debuting former Ryzen champion Kai Asakura. Joining me to break it all down will be the man commanding play-by-play on the pay-per-view broadcast, the voice of the UFC, the one, the only, the great Mr. John Anik. John is one of the very first people who gave me the time of day or interviews in mixed martial arts as an up-and-coming reporter back in 2011. Still a good friend to this day, always generous with his time, and so happy to have him here on the show for the very first time. We'll take a quick break here and be right back with John to talk some UFC 310 and a little bit more. And we are back now with one of my very favorite people in the biz, Mr. John Anik, who will be leading the pay-per-view call once again at UFC 310. John, the final pay-per-view of the year. And I think as we get into award season here in December, I need to be the first one to dish out to you. I think you get the All Hustle Award as the only person I can find who's been to every UFC pay-per-view in 2024.
Well, I don't know if that's true, but I would take your word for it because you lead the league in research. But yeah, it's kind of nice to have the last pay-per-view on December 7th. And then the next one isn't until mid-January, as you well know. I think this is our 14th pay-per-view of the year, and 13 are already in the can. And I will say, too, maybe there isn't the sex appeal at UFC 310 that people are used to, but I'm telling you, bro, the depth on this fight card is such that we made our handicappers on the Anik and Florian podcast pick 11 of the 14 fights. So I think that speaks to something. And we didn't even pick Chase Hooper versus Clay Guida. So I'm excited to get to Vegas tomorrow morning, brother.
Yeah, there's a lot to get into. And to clarify what I meant, like, of course, there's UFC people behind the scenes who go to all the events and, you know, do all the work that it takes. Right. But in terms of like media or on-camera talent or anything, I can't find anyone. Like at least one or two people missed something along the way, myself included. So major respect to you. Even Daniel Cormier missed one pay-per-view at UFC 298, I believe, this year. So.
Well, hey, I mean, I didn't necessarily mean to like draw extra attention to a streak of 100 successive pay-per-views earlier this year, but I was really trying to make a point to a lot of impressionable young broadcasters who probably comprise most of my social media following that, like, there's really no calling in sick in this business, because when Yuri Prohaska and Alex Pineda fought for the first time, I was like as sick as I've ever been on planet Earth. And, you know, calling in sick's not an option, but here we are. Hopefully we make it to Saturday night and we didn't just jinx ourselves on MMA Junkie.
No, of course not. You will you'll be good to go, let's hope. But you mentioned that 100 streak of pay-per-views. Did you figure that out yourself or did someone bring that to your attention?
So it was brought to my attention, but I guess when I took over at UFC 208 in 2017, I didn't have a lot of goals, but you know, I wanted to be reliable and I wanted to make good on all the international travel and everything else. So yes, I think I did have in my mind that I'd love to just get to UFC 307, however far away that seemed. And, you know, here we are staring 310 in the face. So, you know, glad to have it in the can and, whatever they call my number in whatever condition I'm trying to show up. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned UFC 207. That was not your first pay-per-view you called, though. And the first one you did call was UFC 155, which was 12 years ago this month. I kind of noticed that as I was doing some research to bring you onto the show today. And, you know, that circumstance that led you to that was, you know, obviously Mike Goldberg not being able to make that show. How well do you remember getting that phone call that they needed you for UFC 155?
Like it was yesterday, and I don't have great recall, but I was driving around, hopefully not high as a billy goat. I get a call from Tim O'Toole, our great executive, and he's like, hey, man, you're getting called up from AAA to the big leagues. Mike Goldberg can't call UFC 155. We need you to go to Mike Sack's house, our great audio guy, and lay down the combo features to tape and voice the show. And I think that was Christmas Eve, because if memory serves, the pay-per-view was very late in the year, maybe December 29th. So, you know, the Jewish man that I am, who celebrates Christmas and has a lot of Christmas spirit. I think I was at Mike Sack's house late on Christmas Day. And yeah, I was pretty nervous, but I got the major embrace from Joe Rogan, as a lot of us, I think, have experienced his amazing human nature. And the rest is history.
Yep. And I know you mentioned your recall isn't the best, but I'm going to throw a couple trivias your way to see if you can recall any of this stuff from your pay-per-view calls. Let's not say the entire event, but do you remember the first fight of the night you called on a pay-per-view?
First fight of the night at UFC 155? I have no stinking idea.
Jim Miller versus Joe Lauzon.
That was the first fight of the night.
Yeah, that you called. The second fight of the night. Any chance you remember that?
No.
Same player involved in that. Poirier versus Jim Miller at UFC 208 was the second one.
Unbelievable. I do remember fondly some of the Nashville stuff, which was January 20th of 2012 when I called my first UFC show. But you're really racking my brain, as you always do.
Yeah, and I'll list out a few other ones for you here just because they are somewhat notable. Your first TKO finish or knockout finish that you called on a pay-per-view was Costa Philippou versus Tim Boach at UFC 155. The first submission you called was Jacare Souza defeating Tim Boach at UFC 208. And then your first pay-per-view title fight finish was your broadcast partner Daniel Cormier submitting the late Anthony Johnson at UFC 210. That was the first title fight finish you got. But first title fight was Cain Velasquez versus Junior Dos Santos too.
How about that? That is amazing to sort of think back. I wonder the extent to which I sounded like a 12-year-old female voicing some of those calls. But thankfully the voice is a little bit beat up right now. Hopefully we don't have to get any polyps removed anytime soon, Michael.
That's funny. Yeah, no, you. I listened back. You definitely had some good calls, but of course, you've come a long way since then. So I'm sure any of us listening back would cringe a little bit ourselves, but that's just the way it goes, right?
Those Bellator 2009 calls, I hope they're buried forever.
That's funny. They might be one day. Who knows? We'll see. Anyways, let's get on to UFC 310, John. I mean, I wanted to bring you on. Obviously, we kind of talked about you'll be leading the call here. And since this is such a deep card, I thought we could try to touch a little bit on each fight. And I threw together some true or false questions that I just want to throw your way. And if you just want to give a true or false and then move on to the next one, we can. If there's something you want to expand, you can feel free to do that as well. So we will start out with the opening fight of the night. Kennedy Njuku returns from a quick turnaround from Abu Dhabi. True or false, Kennedy Njuku making this quick turnaround proves that his move to heavyweight was the right call.
True. And bro, I got to tell you, Stephen Wright in his corner from the war room right after he beat Chris Barnett. You picked it up on broadcast, or at least when some people maybe were in commercial break, but he went right over to him. He was like, you didn't absorb any damage. We could try to turn this thing around quickly. And lo and behold, here is Kennedy and Zechiku turning it around. So yes, I think this was the move. And, I think for guys like me who are 5'8¾", all these guys are massive, but Kennedy has a heavyweight frame. And I think when he rounds into it, he can make some headway. So yeah, I think it's a good move for Kennedy and Zechiku.
There you go. You mentioned you did not speak too much of Clay Guida and Chase Hooper on your podcast, so I'll throw you on here. See if you've done your research, how up to date you are here. True or false, Clay Guida versus Chase Hooper is the biggest age difference in modern UFC history.
I guess I'm going to need to add that to my fighter cards. I don't think you would have asked me if that wasn't true. I'll say true.
It is true. Modern UFC history is the handicap there. The biggest age gap in UFC history overall was Hoist Gracie versus Ron Van Cleef at UFC 4, which I believe was like 53 versus 26. And we have 42 versus 25 here.
Wow. So the handicappers must love Chase Hooper then this weekend. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it must. Obviously, Clay Guida, a warrior who's been around already in the Hall of Fame. I mean, this type of matchmaking, what do you think of this? We saw something similar on the women's side a few months ago with Carolina Kovalkiewicz versus Yasmin Lucindo. I think that was like 16 years. That was the biggest on the women's side. Do you find these type of matchups compelling when there's this much of an age gap between athletes?
Well, I think it's circumstantial. I find Chase Hooper to be particularly compelling at this stage of his career. These guys did have a grappling match against one another that was won by Chase Hooper. So there is some connective tissue there and sort of a little bit of a backstory. But, I think the question for me, and it's Clay Guida's 37th UFC appearance and nothing like his ball of energy, obviously, when he hits that inspection zone with his brother. But how good can Chase Hooper be? I think most of your audience would suggest that maybe right now the ceiling is not championship. Can Chase Hooper get to the top 15? I think he can. I think he's developmentally worked himself into a really good spot. So I'm excited to see what he can do. The Clay Guida test is always sort of a challenging one with that hair flying around and that style flying around and everything else. So, we'll see how it goes. But you know, I'm excited to see what Chase Hooper potentially can do in terms of career-wise exceeding some expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. And on to Michael Chiesa versus Max Griffin. True or false, John, Michael Chiesa is the nearest and dearest tough winner to your heart because of the tough 15 live season.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, maybe you could bring up one of my dear friends who won the Ultimate Fighter that I'm not thinking about. But my gosh, man, I mean, it's the only time I was in the Ultimate Fighter house. It was back in 2012. And as you know, part of the impetus for my hire from ESPN and a big cornerstone of my job was going to be that I was going to host the Ultimate Fighter, because theretofore the Ultimate Fighter was going to be live. And I still would submit to you that the Ultimate Fighter live was the best season. But you couldn't necessarily manipulate the reality content the way you would have liked to. And as such, it was the only live season. And that was part of the reason why I actually left Las Vegas and no longer am a Nevada resident. But yes, the Chiesa family, near and dear to my heart. And nice to see Mike and Vince Pichel and a few others still sticking around.
Yeah. Do you think Mike has, is he like the most poised to kind of maybe join the group of broadcasters coming up? I know he got some road to UFC experience recently. He told me that's one of his big goals for 24. Do you think we see him introduced, you know, sometime in the future here?
I feel like he and I kind of manifested this at the Ultimate Fighter house in 2012, because at that point in time, he certainly knew more about mixed martial arts than I did, as just this rabid mixed martial arts fanatic. So that is something that I think really helps him in the job. And I also think that he, you know, meshes knowledge and personality and communication really well. So yes, I do think he's a rising star and a budding superstar. And I think it's an eventuality that he is among the men sitting to my right for fight night and pay-per-view calls. So first things first, but hopefully the manifestation actually bears some fruit and he gets the gig, because he certainly put in the time. And I know the man would prepare as well as anybody.
Yeah, definitely. On to Cody Durden versus Joshua Van. True or false, Cody Durden is the most underrated out at flyweight right now.
It's a tough division, man, right? Like, I'm fighter first, and I like Cody, and I'm hoping he watches this and he puts his nickname on the front of his name instead of in the middle. We got to go custom-made Cody Durden, not this Cody custom-made Durden.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he is a well-rounded guy. He trains as hard as anybody. He's got a number next to his name. I thought I might get a Joshua Van question because he had next to no preparation for Edgar Chaires at Noche UFC and turned in a great effort there. But yes, I am a custom-made Cody Durden fan, but is he the most underappreciated, underrated guy in the division? I just don't know. I have to sit on the fence.
Yeah, it's a hard one. I know there's a lot of good flyweights out there right now, so that's a tricky one. We'll give you a allow you to sit on the fence for that one, John. On to the next, Chris Weidman versus Eric Anders. True or false, this will be Chris Weidman's retirement fight.
True or false, Thanksgiving was not fun for these two gentlemen.
Yes.
I'm going to say false, and I know that's the minority opinion, but I'm coming to you now having had a fighter meeting with Chris 2 weeks ago because, of course, as you know, this fight was to happen in Madison Square Garden. And really, I don't know if the word is atrophy when it comes to the leg, right? But he broke his leg in half April 2021, and in the Bruno Silva and Brad Tavares fights, the leg really wasn't all the way there. It's not to take anything away from anything either of those men accomplished in fight against Chris, but finally the leg has something resembling strength and push-off ability, and that was something that we got in the fighter meeting. So, you know, I'm excited to see what Chris can do, but I don't think it's going to be the final walk. Would it have been in Madison Square Garden with a win? Maybe, but I think you get at least two more out of Chris Weidman.
Interesting. Yeah, and I guess you'll be able to find out more from him if you do another fighter meeting this week, because he is not being brought to Media Day on Wednesday, despite them bringing 18 athletes to the card. You couldn't just slide Chris Weidman, the former champion, in there as well.
I'll tell you, the fighter meetings are Wednesday and not Thursday. I would imagine we will not be sitting down with him again. I'm trying to pull up the notes as we're talking. But yeah, I don't know if we're going to sit down with Chris again. That's interesting.
Okay. On to Randy Brown versus Brian Battle. True or false, this is the sleeper fight on UFC 310.
There's no doubt about it. This is the fight that everybody's talking about. And there have been fights on recent cards. Marcus McGee was the guy everybody was talking about on a recent big show. This is the fight, right? Randy Ruboy Brown is plus 190 right now. Brian Battle is the minus 230 betting favorite. And gosh, it really speaks to the depth of this division and how hard it is to get that number 15 next to your name. I remember how hard it was for Bilal to get a number back in the day, right? I think both of these guys deserve to be ranked. And what's also interesting, too, is that both of them have legitimate championship aspirations, right? I mean, look at Randy Brown's body of work. Look at the man's last seven or eight fights. I think the only loss is to three-name Jack in fucking Perth. So I have high hopes for both gentlemen. I'm surprised to see just how wide the betting spread is.
Yeah, a little bit surprised there as well. Okay, on to the next. Movsar Eloyo versus Aljamain Sterling. The winner of this fight is going to have to win at least two more before a title shot. True or false?
False. Movsar Eloyo, if he beats Aljamain Sterling, his next fight is a main event or a title eliminator. It has to be done, Mike. It has to be done, right? The guy's what, 18-0? I mean, what'd you say?
I said that worries me with this featherweight division. It just feels like it might be a long slog type of thing.
I understand. I do have on my fighter card that in January of 2022, Movsar Eloyo was booked against Ilya Topuria. And stylistically, that is a really challenging matchup, I would think, for Ilya. So we'll see what Movsar can do with Aljo this weekend. I mean, again, you talk about a wide betting spread. Eloyo is a huge favorite against Aljamain Sterling. So first things first, but gosh, could you imagine? I have Movsar. Yeah, it would speak to the depth of the division, right? I mean, we got Diego Lopez. We got Alexander Volkanovski, right? You're probably right that he's going to have to win twice more. But real quick, if I could expand upon this. Since Diego Lopez and Movsar Eloyo fought at UFC 288 in May of 2023, Movsar fought one time against Arnold Allen. And it's not by design or his fault. And Diego Lopez is 5-0 since that point in time. So, yeah, I think for Movsar, a finish would be useful.
Very useful. I need to double check this one, but I'm pretty sure no one has opened their UFC career 9-0 with nine consecutive decision wins. So that obviously hurts you a little bit. There has been fighters who have had their first nine promotional wins, Caitlin Chookagian, by decision, but no one who's like won consecutively without a loss there. So I just think he really needs that. And I know he wants it and his team wants it, but he's fighting these really good guys, and Aljamain Sterling is not going to be an easy one to finish either.
Well, and not to suggest that he dominated Arnold Allen, because that was a close fight, but I believe it still was a unanimous decision for Movsar Eloyo. And even in the Diego Lopez fight, in which Lopez had a lot of shining moments, this Eloyo guy, man, he really is. He's the total package. And I think mentally too, right? Like I was asked about Alexandre Pantoja headlining this weekend, what is his greatest asset? And I think it's just the ability to push through the wall. Anytime he has to push through that wall of adversity or cardio abandonment, he just pushes through it. And I think Eloyo, who has the same chief corner, is cut from the same cloth.
Yep. I can't bring myself to get upset about bout orders in 2024. I mean, we're watching the fights anyways. We're covering them all the same, so it really doesn't bother me. But this seems to be a storyline going in that Aljamain Sterling and Movsar aren't on the main card here. What's your take on this?
It's tricky, right? I mean, there is a method to the madness in terms of designing these pay-per-view main cards. And I think Bo Nickel, in some part, paid for the fact that Viviane Araújo's opponent, Karina Silva, didn't necessarily bring the type of game that people expected in her biggest showcase fight to date. And so that was sort of a little bit of a pedestrian start to that pay-per-view, and Bo Nickel paid for it, right? So Crone Gracie versus Bryce Mitchell, right? Does that, it stand to reason, have a chance to be more chaotic than Movsar Eloyo and Aljamain Sterling? I don't know. Certainly, I think if fans want to talk about this as a talking point, when you have an undefeated guy taking on a former champion and they're fighting on the preliminary portion, people can wonder aloud why that is happening. But I do think that maybe there is some forecast for some grappling exchanges that aren't maybe easy on the eyes between those two. I think they're both great fights, and I'm sort of with you, man. I mean, my preparation doesn't change, and at least for Aljo, it stands to reason. I think the prelims be on ESPN2 and FX, more people be watching him than the pay-per-view. So there you go.
Yep, exactly. That's the proper context to put it in. And if you look at both these guys, what they've said, Aljo about it, he just said, I'm going to show UFC they made a mistake. Movsar says, no one's ever given me anything easy. Here we are again. So it seems like they're both taking this in the right way.
And dude, like Randy Brown's a main card fighter, right? Brian Battle's a main card fighter. Is there anybody else on the prelim?
Hey, Luke, Dominic Reyes, Anthony Smith, a lot of these guys.
Right, right. Yep. We just got a lot of depth in the Ultimate Fighting Championship. The combat sports leader just got a lot of depth.
Let's go. On to the next. Most MMA fans, yourself included, true or false, are happy Vicente Luque is not fighting Nick Diaz on this night.
True. Yeah. True. because short of some optimal preparation that that we didn't necessarily see in the works, you know, I'm just not sure what version of Diaz would have showed up. And now Vicente Luque, still just 33 years old, gets to prove that he shouldn't be a betting underdog to Temba Garimbo. So we got a lot of storylines at 310.
We do, yeah. Temba, I don't know if you saw the messages he posted like from like a year ago, basically saying manifesting this fight, as we speak of manifesting earlier on. Like it seems he really was on track. I know he said at one point that he was going to be the champion by the end of 2024. Obviously not there yet, but I think this is closer. This fight, if he wins, had him closer than I thought he would be at the end of this year.
Yeah, getting a ranked opponent, and if anybody follows him on social media, you know that he's been training for this fight, expectant that Nick Diaz wouldn't be able to compete against Vicente Luque. And yeah, it's crazy to think Garimbo lost his UFC debut, and now I think he's reeled off four straight and could have a number next to his name come Monday.
Correct. On to the next. True or false, the winner of Dominic Reyes versus Anthony Smith will fight for a UFC title once more in their career at some point.
I'll say true. I do believe that if Dominic Reyes can hold serve as the favorite here, that he could get fast-tracked, right? Just given some of the adversity that he experienced, given how relatively close the John Jones fight was, even though for the record, I thought Thiago Santos had a cleaner case for a win over John Jones for the record. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think for Dominic Reyes, that would be within reach. And certainly for Anthony Lionheart-Smith, if he could spring the upset here, I would never doubt that man in any capacity or in any walk of professional life. But yeah, I do think it's optimistically true.
Okay. A couple fun ones here as we get into starting off the main card. The winner of Nate Landwehr versus Duhu Choi will give the most memorable post-fight interview of the night with Joe Rogan.
That's a funny question. So if we need an interpreter, Mike...
Yeah.
What a dick with that question. So if we need an interpreter, I'll say false. But Nate Landwehr right now is the betting favorite. A lot of people like the matchup for him. Duho Choi certainly can be a real problem, especially early. But yes, if Nate the Train gets a microphone, best of luck to everybody else competing at UFC 310, topping that man on a hot mic.
Okay, speaking of Joe Rogan will make at least one flat earth joke versus Bryce Mitchell versus Crone Gracie. True or false?
False. I think Joe will be so excited about the grappling that that he won't. We'll see. If he does, I don't know how I'll react now that I have received this question.
How much grappling do you think we actually get in this fight? It feels like on one side, I mean, I guess it depends what version of Crone Gracie shows up. If he's wanting to, you know, pull guard and fall to his back a little bit that we saw last time, or do you think maybe he will be a little more equipped for a striking fight with Bryce Mitchell if it leads to that?
I think we'll see it all. I'm hoping that we see it all. I think there were some valuable lessons learned by Crone Gracie in the aftermath of his last fight. And we haven't seen Bryce Mitchell, you know, since he was flatlined by Josh Emmett. So I'm excited to see it. I mean, it's crazy. And I hate to keep bringing it back to sort of the betting line, right? But Crone Gracie, there are a lot of unknowns. There are a lot of variables when it comes to handicapping him. And the price next to him just keeps getting bigger every time I go into the sports book, you know, so much so that Crone Gracie is like plus 500 right now. You know, I think Bryce Mitchell is going to want to strike and prove that he is the better striker. So we'll see what happens. I'm excited to see it.
Okay, getting into the serious business here, the truly serious business at UFC 310. Alexander Volkov versus Ciryl Gane. Volkov winning would be the most chaotic outcome possible for the heavyweight division in its current state.
True, but I think he would just have to do what Bilal Muhammad and Alexandre Pantoja and others did, and that's just sit, right? Because if Volkov is able to stack wins over Sergey Pavlovich and Ciryl Gane on the back end of this five-fight winning streak, you got to wait, man. There's nothing else to accomplish. This man has won major titles outside the UFC. If Ciryl Gane wins, yeah, I think it would be one more fight just given the championship opportunities that he has received. Mm-hmm. But given how elusive this title shot has been for Volkov, yes, true, it would be definitely chaotic. But I just think for Volkov, and if I have a fighter meeting with the guy, I certainly will say not to get ahead of ourselves, but you got to be prepared to, you know, knock a man out and sit if that's what it takes.
Yeah, and I mean, true or false, though, if you're Tom Aspinall, you are rooting for Gane to win this fight.
True.
Yeah, just, I mean, I keep thinking about it, if it all plays out, like, especially if John Jones walks away. I know you told MMA Junkie Radio last week you're confident this fight between Jones and Aspinall happens, maybe International Fight Week, but say John does walk away or takes a hiatus. I mean, you want Aspinall versus Gon. I feel like if you're the UFC, we saw Aspinall versus Volkov not that long ago in London. Right. It was a very one-sided fight.
Right. Yes. And I do think that Gon just has an entire nation behind him in a way, not unlike some of the Aussies do. And that moves a lot of needles. So yes, I do believe that there's traction there. And yeah, I guess a hiatus for John Jones wouldn't surprise me, but I am bullish on us seeing that fight. And let's be optimistic for July 2025.
Yeah, we keep hoping. We've seen, I mean, the one thing John has not done that Dana White said he would do is disappear. He has not. He's been active on social media. He is at Mike Perry's Dirty Boxing event doing interviews and all that kind of stuff. He's very still present and in the forefront, which was what Dana White said he would not be doing at all.
When George St. Pierre beat Michael Bisping to win the undisputed UFC middleweight championship, if he thought that he needed another 10, 15 million, whatever it is, to gain financial freedom for the rest of his life, he probably would have stuck around to fight Robert Whittaker. Maybe not, right? But there was a lot of legacy preservation, I think, going on with GSP and not defending that middleweight championship, right? And, you know, I would pardon John Jones, as I've said, for some legacy preservation. But my thesis statement on this is, what is John Jones's net worth, right? And what does he need to make to fight Tom Aspinall? And there are only a select few individuals who have the answers to those questions. But I think he wouldn't mind making a, you know, a payday that, you know, pays him like the greatest of all time on the way out the door. And I think the Aspinall fight, just given the fan interest in it, would afford him that opportunity. So we'll see.
Yep. Hashtag pay John Jones. Give the man his fuck you money. Let's make it happen.
There you go. There you go.
Okay. On to the co-main event here. This one a little bit on the longer side, but giving you some info here. If Ian Garry wins this fight, Ian Machado Garry, rather, he'll be the second welterweight ever to start 9-0 in the UFC, joining Kamaru Usman, who ended up getting a title shot in his 10th fight, which Ian Garry would be poised for if he wins this. So true or false, Gary's resume going into said potential title shot would be better than Usman's. And I will read you their 9 wins here. Kamaru Usman's run to his title shot: debut, Haider Hassan, second round arm triangle choke. Leon Edwards, unanimous decision. Alexander Yakovlev, unanimous decision. Warley Alves, unanimous decision. Sergio Moraes, first round KO. Emil Meek, unanimous decision. Damian Maia, unanimous decision. Rafael Dos Anjos, unanimous decision. Now this is Ian Garry's list. Jordan Williams, first round KO. Darian Weeks, unanimous decision. Gabe Green, unanimous decision. Song Kinan, third round TKO. Daniel Rodriguez, first round TKO. Neil Magny, unanimous decision. Jeff Neal, split decision. Michael Page, unanimous decision. And then Shavkat, question mark on how he would win there. True or false, Ian Garry's run better than Usman?
True. I don't know how you could argue really otherwise. I mean, Damian Maia, world title challenger. Leon Edwards in 2015, different than the championship version. Rafael Dos Anjos, probably the signature win there. But then Michael Venom Page, a really hard guy to prepare for, to fight, to look good against. And then, yeah, if you are the first to beat Shavkat Rakhmonov in MMA, given what we all think Shavkat is, when you throw in D-Rod and Neil Magny, Ian Machado Garry, to be sure, and he's so worthy of this opportunity too, right? He's 8-0 in the UFC. He has had the stronger schedule than Shavkat Rakhmonov, you know, even if he hasn't done it with as many style points. I'm really excited, you know, to see what Ian can do as a plus 300 underdog this weekend.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And I mean, that interview that he did with Ariel Helwani on Monday, I'm sure you maybe saw some clips floating around. The dude was on fire. He hasn't really done much in the way of media leading up to this fight. You know, I tried to track him down. They said he's trying to step back a little bit, but he did that one and feels like it was all he really needed. He lit the world on fire. So I'm infinitely more excited for that fight now after everything Ian said about kind of hyping this one up and their training sessions in the past and stuff. But on the flip side, true or false, if Shavkat Rakhmonov finishes Ian Garry, we have to anoint him as the most dangerous finisher in welterweight history. And before you answer, the only people who would have more finishes than him in welterweight history at this point would be Matt Brown, Vicente Luque, Thiago Alves, and Josh Koscheck.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a numbers game, right? Like, I'm not going to sit here and anoint him over Matt Brown right now, but he's a more versatile finisher than Matt Brown. Mm-hmm. But Matt Brown was the first name that came to mind for me, just the division's most prolific knockout artist historically. Carlos Condit was a guy who came to mind just because of the versatile nature of him as a finisher, even if he didn't have a lot of those in the UFC. I mean, I'm old, right? I'm long in the tooth. I got a white beard. So I'll say Matt Brown's, albeit slightly over Shavkat, but it really is amazing. What sets Shavkat apart, and he says it himself, is just his ability to find a finish and find it so quickly and find it in all areas, whether it's knees or elbows or feet or chokes or manipulation of joints. The guy's got it all.
Yeah, he's very dynamic in that regard. I really am fascinated to see what he can do in a five rounder here. So this will be curious to see if Gary can push him there, because that's what he says the plan is, to take him into those championship rounds. Okay, on to the main event here, John. True or false, if Kai Asakura becomes UFC flyweight champion on Saturday, UFC has to go to Japan for his first title defense.
False.
False.
Because... well, I'd love to go to Japan for his first title defense. Selfishly, I think I speak for the entire staff. I should have probably answered true. But I try to be a man of veracity, and like, the UFC doesn't have to do anything. And I say that not to sound like a shill or somebody who works for the company, right? But what a year it has been. You know what I mean? We're trying to get to Spain. We're trying to get to South Africa. I think all of those things are ambitious. Obviously, those countries don't have the MMA history that Japan does. I hope that part of the reason Kai Asakura is getting this opportunity is obviously him as a mixed martial arts stylist, his ability to produce knockouts. He has a massive following already, but I'd imagine, you know, you have your first Japanese born champion, and that maybe opens up that market in a way that maybe it isn't open right now. But I just think the demand for the UFC live event right now has never been stronger. And I know there are US markets that are dying to get some of these shows. So, you know, everywhere can't be Salt Lake City, Utah, getting back-to-back-to-back pay-per-views. But I'll say false, but I am hopeful that it is true and that we go to Japan 2025 if, in fact, Kai Asakura is able to spring the upset this week.
Yeah, I mean, if Tatsuro Taira had won his fight and you had that sitting there right in front of you, if you could do a Japan versus Japan thing, I think you would just have to move mountains for something like that. But in this instance, who knows? We'll see what happens. Pantoja, when I spoke to him the other day, says it's his dream to fight in Japan. And I'm like, buddy, I don't know if that's going to happen unless you lose this fight, which I'm sure is not your plan here.
Right. So. You're doing an immediate rematch in Japan.
Exactly.
And again, if you were talking to a UFC executive, they might say true. Yes, it's in the works. It's absolutely happening. So we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. As we get on to Pantoja here, and this will leave us into a little bit of a debate that I prepared you for here, John. True or false, Alexandre Pantoja has the most difficult divisional GOAT argument to overcome in trying to surpass Demetrius Johnson's legacy at 125 pounds.
So I will say true, because as I was getting ready to preview this fight, I started to talk about Pantoja in some of those terms. Mm-hmm. And then as I was giving this response, I started to think about Demetrius Johnson. And it's almost like his run was such that I don't really even care how many title defenses Mighty Mouse had. It just was so special and maybe inexorably linked with my formative years as an MMA broadcaster, so that I can't even think in another way. Mm-hmm. John Jones is the only other guy that comes to mind, because when I think about Alex Pereira right now, the biggest superstar in our sport at present, and I think about the two former champions on his resume, Yuri Prohaska and Jamal Hill, and they just don't stack up to the Rampages and Rashads and Lyoto Machida being dropped unconscious and Vitor Belfort and Chael Sonnen, and on and on and on and on it goes. But I just feel like, what would Pantoja need to do? Defend this thing seven times to open up the conversation? Like, I tried to open it this week, and then I stepped back from it. Mm-hmm. So I think DJ is on the Mount Rushmore for me. He will never be off of it. But how is another light heavyweight going to supplant John Jones? So those guys are neck and neck. They're neck and neck.
It is really, really hard. I mean, Pantoja, I think one thing, I guess, that's now maybe trending in his direction, I know he was talking about maybe 35 at some point. He's completely closed the door at that. He said he only wanted that for Sean O'Malley because they had that history and he's dead set on staying in this division, which was refreshing to hear from a champion saying, no, I don't want the two belts. I want to stay put. But yeah, it seems like he's at least committed to this. But if he wins, I know Kai Asakura technically isn't ranked, but he will be in the aftermath of this fight, and he would then be 10-0 against ranked flyweights in his division, Pantoja, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, and Kenny Florian and I, for our podcast, just went back and watched his UFC debut, and the evolution has been marked under Pahumpina. So, yeah, we'll see what Pantoja can do. I do think he is criminally underappreciated when it comes to his pound-for-pound status. And, you know, I haven't seen a weakness. He's never been finished in, like, 30 fights. And, yeah, I think it's going to take Asakura's best, but he certainly has a lot of long-range weaponry on which to draw. I think it's a fascinating title fight.
Yeah, it really is. And to go back to what you just said there of like who could kind of dethrone their divisional goats, the thing that I think makes like it so tough as you trend towards this, right? You mentioned it. Jones had all those former champions that still existed in his division that he was able to beat and build his legacy off. And you see a lot of guys like Israel Adesanya. I don't think he fully got there to surpass Anderson Silva, but he has the win over him. He at least had the opportunity to fight him. No one's going to be able to fight George St. Pierre at welterweight. Maybe Amanda Nunes comes back at like women's bantamweight, but I feel like it's so important to get these legacy names on your resume. And some people were there in a time window where they had the opportunity and some other guys weren't. And that makes it a lot more difficult to kind of craft that out when you're beating people or when you can't beat people who have held a title or challenged for a title or things like that.
Yeah, I was roundly criticized at one point for suggesting that the last style bender, Israel Adesanya, had supplanted Anderson Silva as the greatest middleweight champion of all time. And I did step back from that, I think, a little bit. But the greater point was that this era, and Joe Rogan says this all the time, is producing the best mixed martial arts talent. So You can argue as to who is the greatest featherweight of all time, Jose Aldo, Max Holloway, Alexander Volkanovski. Might be fucking Ilya Topuria, right? Who just beat two of those guys. So Largely, I believe that the champions of this era are the greatest fighters of all time in division. And I do think when I look at the guys that Israel beat and when I look at what he was able to do in that 20 or so, 24 month window, it stacks up pretty favorably to Anderson Silva's run, even if it wasn't as long.
What does it take for someone to surpass Dominic Cruz as your bantamweight goat?
It's a tricky thing, right? I mean, forget the fact that the guy's my best friend. I felt like if Aljamain Sterling beat Sean O'Malley, he would have been there. So Aljo, I think, was close. I tell you, this may Rob Dwalishwili is absolutely something. And if he can add Umar Nurmagomedov and potentially another win over Piotr Jan, a title defense or two, this dude's tracking to do really big things at 35. But I do like that, Dominic Cruz's run has been historically appreciated. I look forward to him being inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame. I look forward to his retirement fight. I know he is no longer ranked, but Cruz, he's got a black eye every day, so he's probably going to sign a contract soon.
Yep. Who's your lightweight goat?
So BJ Penn has to be a part of the conversation, to be sure. It's interesting how you compare Khabib Nurmagomedov to Islam Makhachev. Charles Oliveira deserves consideration as well, But a prime BJ Penn at 155 pounds, Michael.
I know.
Isn't that the answer?
And you had to be there to, remember those days, the fights with Kenny Florian, Sean Cherk, all those ones were just amazing and so special. And you knew that this guy maybe still wasn't operating at his absolute top of the skill set. And it's crazy to point to someone who I think has 12 or 13 career losses and like 16 wins as a divisional GOAT. But yeah, if you were there and you remember that at its time, it was truly something special. And we just marveled at that man's talent.
A prime BJ Penn versus a prime Islam Makhachev is an absolutely fascinating fight. And I do think Islam is tracking to be the greatest lightweight of all time. But I think unlike Pantoja, there are two things. The weight cut, right, is part of it. And then just that legacy building thing for double champs, that Islam, I just think really, really is prioritizing. And I feel like he feels like it's more natural for him and a natural progression for him, right? Like Pantoja may never fight at 35, right? So I don't know. We'll see what happens. I hope Makhachev sticks around at 55 and tries to distance himself from Khabib and BJ and anybody else.
Yeah, I agree. And I think part of that, I guess, will be dependent on how long Bilal Muhammad can keep that welterweight title, because I think as long as he's holding that belt, Islam is going to be cool staying at 55 too.
Well, and I think there are lightweight challengers, right? Like the cupboard isn't bare. It really, if Islam doesn't feel as though he can make the weight, and I know it's a treacherous cut, nothing easy about it, right? But if he doesn't think he can make the weight, that's one thing. But if he does feel like he can make the weight, I mean, there's certainly the Armand fight and just a division that has a lot of guys that I think are worthwhile. So Charles, right? I mean, come on, So I don't know. I mean, it's interesting when you think about like some of the guys at 70, right? Like Charles Oliveira, like pick your poison, right? That would make me move up, you know? yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens. But I just, I mean, I don't think Makhachev has like five more lightweight cuts in him necessarily. So.
Yeah, no, I struggle to see that as well. Okay, just last division, I guess, since we mentioned him, Bilal, what do you think is... Usman, I think, was close for GSP. He, especially if he had got that win over Leon Edwards and tied Anderson Silva's win streak record, like that's something you can really throw in someone's face as a huge chip in your favor. But he fell just short of it. We have the losing skid now. I think he's the clear number two. He passed Matt Hughes in my mind, for sure. Where do you think, what does Bilal need to do to get into that conversation? As we talked about earlier, I know people are like rubbed the wrong way by the little exchange between him and Usman, but just because of the Usman's losing skid, I think that's a huge fight. Like the legacy names we mentioned, if he can get Usman on the resume, that goes a huge way in kind of building that argument.
It does. Whatever condition Kamaru Usman's knees are when those two would fight, I don't know. But as you well know, history doesn't necessarily look at asterisks and things like that. And you even mentioned the last Stylebender's win over Anderson Silva, right? That was not a prime Anderson Silva, but still a very competitive Anderson Silva at that. So what does my friend Bilal Muhammad need to do to supplant George St. Pierre as the greatest welterweight of all time? One thing working in his favor is what I mentioned, the era. Right? How does George St. Pierre stack up to the Shavkat Rachmanov type contenders of the world? And unfortunately, the answer is I don't know. But I think, not unlike Demetrius Johnson and John Jones, I think George St. Pierre is on this pedestal for fight fans like me who maybe are close to 50. That I don't know, dude. He'd have to have us be having this conversation in 2026. Which is to say he would have to add Shavkat Rachmanov or Ian Machado Gary or a few other scalps, maybe a Kamaru Usman. But I really think for Bilal, it's like extending this unbeaten streak to 15, 16 fights and adding a couple more welterweights and making himself impossible to deny in that conversation. But he's well on his way, right? The unbeaten streak's a big part of it. And even though there's only been one championship fight, it was pretty damn dominant.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, he has going for him too. The thing that I also think is important is defeating eras. Like you had the ones kind of before him, the Damian Mayas, the Wonder Boys, the guys who have come up with him now, Leon Edwards. And then if he can defeat someone like a Shavkat or an Ian Gary, who's quote unquote next generation after him, that's a huge thing as well. The people who are able to defeat those multiple generations, which is very much something that John Jones has done. And he is our MMA goat, I imagine.
But what a great time. Yes, John Jones is my MMA goat, to be sure. But what a great time to be an MMA fan, right? Like, there's so many fascinating storylines. And the one thing I say about UFC 310, it's like you got ranked fighters all over the place. So I think this was a good way for us to sort of attack the card. And, you know, hopefully people enjoyed it.
Yeah, we can leave it at that. And I think you might be able to open the pay-per-view with a similar thing as you did at UFC 155, John, which I wrote down. It was, we have a lot to get to as we close the book on 2012. And you could probably say the same about 2024.
God, I would cringe looking at myself doing that pay-per-view open. Thankfully, you did the work for us. And thanks for the thoughtful nature of that too, my man.
All right. Appreciate you, John. Thank you so much for joining the bonfire for the first time. Hopefully, we'll do this many more times in the future. It was a lot of fun. Appreciate you, man.
Thank you, buddy. Anytime, you pick the right name for the show.
All right. We will take a quick break and then be right back to wrap things up. And that does it for another episode of The Bonfire. Thanks so much again to John for joining the show. We covered a whole lot of ground there when it comes to UFC 310. Would love to know your guys' opinions on the divisional GOAT debates. Did we get it right? Did we have it wrong? Let me know. Leave a comment. And while you're at it, please make sure to like the video, subscribe to the channels on whatever platform you are listening to. It means a whole lot over here. So we will see you back here next week to digest the aftermath of UFC 310. Maybe look ahead a little bit to UFC Tampa, the final UFC event overall of 2024. Going to be a good week. Enjoy it all. We'll have plenty of coverage over on MMA Junkie, and we will talk to you all back here very soon.